We are now going to be looking at 1 Corinthians chapter 13, although we will begin with the verse before and end with the verse after. It includes both those verses. So 1 Corinthians chapter 12, verses 31 through chapter 14, verse 1, the first half. So we are talking about women and men in the church. Basically, what happens in church? And we're going to be discussing the way of love. This is the center of this essay number 4. And this essay itself, or this section today itself, is divided into 7 parts. The center of today's section is love defined negatively. The outer envelope, chapter 12, verse 31, and chapter 14, verse 1a, begins and ends, bookends this passage. It talks about zeal and pursuit of the spiritual gifts. Some of the themes that we find repeated in chapter 13 are the triad, the tongues, prophecy, knowledge, the triad, love, faith, and hope, the idea of complete versus incomplete, and permanence versus temporality.
Temporariness.
So let's begin by going through the passage. But earnestly desire the higher gifts, and I will show you a still more excellent way. If I speak in the tongues of men and of angels, but have not love, I am a noisy gong or a clanging cymbal. And if I have prophetic powers and understand all mysteries and knowledge, and if I have all faith so as to remove mountains, but have not love, I am nothing. If I give away all I have, and if I deliver up my body to be burned, but have not love, I gain nothing. Love is patient and kind. Love does not envy or boast. It is not arrogant or rude. It does not insist on its own way. It is not irritable or resentful. It does not rejoice at wrongdoing, but rejoices with the truth. Love bears all things, believes all things, hopes all things, endures all things. Love never ends. As for prophecies, they will pass away. As for tongues, they will cease. As for knowledge, it will pass away. For we know in part, and we prophesy in part. But when the perfect comes, the partial will pass away. When I was a child, I spoke like a child. I thought like a child. I reasoned like a child. When I became a man, I gave up childish ways. For now we see in a mirror dimly, but then face to face. For I know in part, then I shall know fully, even as I have been fully known. So now faith, hope, and love abide, these three, but the greatest of these is love. Pursue love, and earnestly desire the spiritual gifts. So,
what he meant to say, and he said it very clearly.
Okay. Chapter 13 is something that's often heard in weddings.
Yeah. Well, another kind.
One comment from what you said.
You can be nice to who you're married to.
And if I have prophetic powers and understand all mysteries and all knowledge, and if I have all faith so as to remove mountains, do you think he's saying more than, is he alluding to something there that we were talking about earlier? To move a mountain? Or is that just a figure of speech? Or did that figure of speech have a lot of history in it?
It has history.
Okay.
That's an interesting.
Well, you know, part of it may be alluding to what Jesus said. You know, if you have faith as small as a mustard seed, so you can say to this mountain, go to the sea, and it will go away. But there is an actual, we'll get to it, but there is a more immediate imagery. So first of all, first thing to notice is that chapter 13 is not necessary to this essay, to the flow. We can read, but earnestly desire the higher gifts, pursue love, and earnestly desire the spiritual gifts. And it makes perfect sense.
So they just kind of clipped this essay into there.
So there's the bookends flow seamlessly. If Paul didn't include it, we would not have missed anything. His point would still have been made. Because what Paul in chapter 12 was talking about were the spiritual gifts. In particular, he was trying to de-emphasize the Corinthian emphasis on tongues. In chapter 14, Paul is going to talk about tongues again. So the topic flows very seamlessly. So why does Paul include this chapter? Why does Paul include the discussion on love? Some think that Paul may have inserted a pre-composed hymn into this discussion. And he may have written it, or it may be something that was present already. Maybe it was some kind of Christian saying that Paul inserted. But the problem is that as we go into it, the details are specifically tailored to the problems that have been discussed already in Corinth. What we can say about chapter 13 is it is a distinct and self-contained unit, but it is intricately tied to the rest of the letter. And Gordon Fee writes in regards to this chapter, unfortunately, however, the love affair with this love chapter has also allowed it to be read regularly apart from its context, which does not make it less true, but causes one to miss too much. Even worse is that reading of it in context which sees it as set over against spiritual gifts. Paul would wince. So frequently how it's read is, let's look at this first, but earnestly desire the higher gifts, and I will show you a still more excellent way. How it's often interpreted is that spiritual gifts are fine, but love is a better way. Love is a more valuable gift. So that's what you should pursue. Which makes sense because in chapter 14, verse 1, it begins, pursue love. The problem is, it also says, and earnestly desire the spiritual gifts. Paul bookends the discussion of love with zealously desire the higher gifts or zealously desire the spiritual gifts. The first problem is love. Paul really never speaks of love as a gift. It is a fruit. And as I just said, Paul tells the Corinthians to continue to zealously pursue, to earnestly desire spiritual gifts, and continues on to discuss them in very elaborate fashion. Another traditional interpretation is that there, in chapter 12, verse 28, Paul gave a list. You know, he began first apostles, second, was it prophets? Anyway, ordinals. And some have taken that to mean a hierarchical order of gifts, with the first gift being more valuable and important than the ones later on in the list. And so the imperative of verse 31 is to, then Paul is telling the Corinthians to desire those things higher on the list. That's another way that this has been interpreted. But the problem is, as we discussed last week, Paul has already established that there is no hierarchy of gifts. All gifts are equally valuable.
With the body.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
The interpretation hinges on this translation that has been handed down, a more excellent way. Now, so when we read that in English, it sounds like Paul is contrasting love as a better way than gifts. But this second half of verse 31 of chapter 12 has interpretation difficulties. The literal translation doesn't make very good sense. How it reads is kath hyperbolein hodon, which literally means more extremely way. And Ken Bailey notes that the word hyperbole can also refer to a mountain pass. And he gives some ancient examples in literature of where that is the case. So what Paul appears to be writing is, and I will give you directions for a journey over the mountain pass.
How to go between the mountains.
Now, chapter 13 contains words and phrases that can describe a mountain journey. For example, higher gifts, journey over a pass, faith that removes mountains, love that never falls.
I noticed that it said falls, not fails.
That word is actually falls.
Love never falls.
Love never falls. And the highest of these is love. So this whole mountain journey metaphor persists throughout chapter 13.
Interesting.
So we don't have to read this chapter as gifts and love being in the same category and one is better than the other. They're in different categories. So, spoiler alert, we're going to start with the summary of this discussion first. Because it just makes it easier to discuss. Mm-hmm. What Paul shows in this chapter is that spiritual gifts have a limited lifespan. It's for the church until the perfect comes. Mm-hmm. On the other hand, love is permanent. In other words, even when God is fully revealed, when Jesus returns, love will continue. Spiritual gifts will cease. Paul also discusses that love is the only context in which Christianity can exist. Religion without love, even with 100% orthodox doctrines and actions, cannot be Christianity. See, Corinthians were saying, we are Christians because we manifest gifts. Uh-huh. And Paul says, but do you have love? Let me explain to you what love looks like and compare that to what I'm seeing in your community. And then decide for yourself if you are Christian or not. The pillars of Christianity are faith, hope, and love. And the greatest of these being love. Gordon Fee writes, thus it is not love versus gifts that Paul has in mind, but love as the only context for gifts. For without the former, the latter have no usefulness at all. But then, neither does much of anything else in the Christian life. Love is not an idea for Paul, not even a motivating factor for behavior. It is behavior. To love is to act. Anything short of action is not love at all. Second, love is not set over against the gifts, precisely because it belongs in a different category altogether. For Paul, it is not gifts to be sure, but better yet, love. Rather, love is the way in which the gifts are to function. To desire earnestly expressions of the Spirit that will build up the community is how love acts in this context.
So he's not saying some people have prophecy and some people have tongues and some people have love and love is the best. That's absurd.
Yeah. But one.
Yeah.
Let's look at this sentence that Gordon Fee wrote. Love is not an idea for Paul, not even a motivating factor for behavior. Now think about that.
Love isn't a reason you do things. Love is simply what you do.
Yeah.
Huh. Love isn't the why.
Love is a verb.
Yes. Yes. It's not an abstract concept.
You don't add love to your behaviors. Love is your behavior.
What is faith and what is hope? In this context, have we messed up the definition?
Faith ultimately is trusting in what God has said.
So what faith are you? Not
bad
at all.
Faith is an action.
You're talking as an
denomination. Yeah.
So uh-huh.
Hope too is an action.
So all three of these are actions, and we need to think of them as that.
Uh-huh.
More like, instead of actions, they are the description of your action. Like your actions are the love of the world that you have. Your hope is, you know, through your actions, your faith. It's all, instead of you saying I'm faithful, it's just that you in generally wake up knowing that the world is what you can make of it and what God has given you, and hope for the best for the people around you and the world itself, and love is, you know, those are all part of your actions of your day.
Mm-hmm.
Instead of saying that I hope I'm going to be okay today, or
no,
I
that's not really what hope is.
It's hard to think of it that way.
Yeah.
Because you always think like, well, I love my baby so much, I'm going to work hard, but that's not why.
Mm-hmm. You're going to love your child, and in loving your child, other actions will be associated with that. It will come along naturally, but loving your child is the primary action.
Yeah, it's a difficult one to say. It's easier to conceptualize and say, oh, okay, but it's a lot harder to just say what I think it's being. Yeah.
What I've been thinking on this week quite a bit is, and I think this may be a cultural thing, at least cultural for me. We think about facts, knowledge, scientific knowledge, scientific facts. Mm-hmm. Whereas Christianity, like you were saying the other day, Christianity is a verb, not a description of a noun. To be a Christian is a verb, not a fact. Everything that we've talked about in Christianity is verbs. God didn't create us to be factual. God created us to be active, to be verb.
Well, and also
to live.
And also Christianity is an expression of who you are. Of when you...
The expression is done through verbs, though, not through facts.
Yeah, yeah.
I'm not a Christian because I believe this. I'm not a Christian because of this fact. I'm a Christian because what I do. It's all verbs. And I don't know if I think that way, but I think that's what I'm hearing, is everything that you keep saying about Paul is verbs.
Yeah.
I think behavior is a good way to say do, because once you say do, it gets into the realm of works, and then that you're all messed up again.
In when we were looking at Romans, Paul described faith as obedience.
God created us to do, to
be
something that's active, uh-huh. not something that is factual.
Static.
Right. Right. To say, yes, I believe in these doctrines isn't Christianity.
Or saying to somebody, oh, I love you, and then not doing anything.
Exactly.
I love you, and then that's it. Oh. That doesn't mean anything to anybody, but instead of I love you, it's here is my work for the day. Uh-huh. And it doesn't necessarily have to be for.
Here is my expression of love for you. With or without the words.
Right.
With or without the saying, I'm doing this because I love you.
Right. It's just pure and simple.
You're being a Christian
right.
to the people around you.
Strangers or anybody, you're just working. Yeah. You're working. And it's not works, though. Like, you're just being.
It's not works,
behavior.
It's being. It's just who it's.
What he says right
simply
here.
Simply who you are, but it's also a in. Being, a very active being.
Who is this guy again that wrote this? The
fear and leader.
Gordon Fee.
Fee. Okay. Love is not, or love is to act. So, in other words, saying that I love you isn't really
love.
An act of something. It's
it
just
is love.
It's just you
know,
saying it.
But at the same time, doing something in because I must love is not love either.
Right. It's just an act. I think Sarah's dad is a pretty good example of that because he never really runs around telling anybody that he likes them or that he loves them and that they're great people or anything like that. But I have never seen him in the slightest take any apprehension to acting for somebody that needs his attention. He's always there for somebody. And when it comes to his family, he's even more there, and when it comes to this baby, he's ridiculously in love with this kid. Like he doesn't do anything in his life in any time of the day that doesn't involve something for this child, it seems like. So he's a good example of that, where you know you don't really hear from him ever that, oh yeah, you're a really great guy, you know, he just is there for you. So I think that's a kind of a good example. And he has Dolores too has a boundless amount of energy for people.
Oh,
it seems like
that's waning.
I mean, what you do with people all the time is amazing. So I think those are good examples of that love.
Well, you know, anytime you interface with somebody, either you love them or you don't love them. You know, either you're there for them, or you're not there for them. You're just there for yourself, you know, making a buck or whatever, you know. But
yeah,
you know, the hope word makes me think of hope versus hopeless. You know, you see people in the hospital who have hope. They try. They, you know, against pain and everything, they try to get better. But then there's people who are hopeless, and they don't have any hope of getting better. You know, they've given up, you know. And, you know, it makes a big difference in their health, whether they have hope or they do not have hope.
A hopeful person acts differently, not because they're acting based on hope, but because it's just who they are. Same with a person who believes, who has faith in what God has promised. You know, they don't act because I have to believe. They, you know, They act based on their beliefs without thinking about it.
Are we saying what I think, if I'm not mistaken, James is the one that talks about works versus faith?
Faith is not works.
Yeah.
Faith.
Yeah.
And too often I think we've heard the argument that works is important in order to have faith, but it's actually the other way around. It's that, yeah. In essence, James is saying the same thing we're saying.
Paul and James are, when it comes down to, they're approaching it from two different places. Yeah.
It's just what you were saying about love. You can say, I love that person, and that's great. But it's your actions that really show that you did love
the person. Whether or not you do, yeah.
And that's what James is saying. And the person is not studying their words. They're not doing the things to chalk up the checklist.
That's just because they're
pretty.
If a person has to think about being loving in order to motivate behavior, they haven't found love yet.
They're trying to achieve love, but
they're just trying to get a favor. Oh, I did this for you, I did this for you, I did this. Can't you at least get this to me? No, I don't.
Guilt trip.
Which, really kind of comes, the difficult thing is, so someone you don't like, someone you disagree with, someone who has hurt you, Jesus did not have to think to himself, okay, I have to love the ones that are crucifying me. He just did.
That's a stretch. Not that he did, but for us to be that person is more than most of us can imagine being.
When he said, forgive them, for they know not what they do. Mm-hmm. It wasn't him, Jesus, thinking to himself, okay, love has to forgive, so therefore I'm going to forgive them. It's
close.
Yeah.
He simply did. And real, actual love is that way.
Well, when there's actions that you don't understand, like where they popped out of from somebody, your mind gets active automatically saying, what happened that brought that up or, whatever. But you can also think of this person and think, there might be a lot of other things in their life. This could have just been an event that was popped out from some other temporal part of their life.
Say, I don't know where that action came from. But this is still a person
that God values, and that if I grew up in their shoes, how would I ever deal with life, But you can have.
But the idea of naturally thinking of each person that way, automatically, because it's who you are, is a stretch for most people.
Yes, but
it's not a but. I mean, there's 2% of the population when you look at that. If that, there's a half of a percent when you look around and you see people that grow up and they just have a natural, distinct character that makes them seem to be able to endure or care or be there for themselves and other people around them. That's a very fraction of the, the percent of people in the world when you see them, and they are basically that way from childhood on. It's not like they're sitting in some room talking about it later on in life and going, oh, well, yeah, I get it. No, they're like, they've been like that their entire lives. And
so can a person become that way?
That's where the but was I was coming in. If you think you're going to marry a person so that you can, you know, through my Christianity, I have to learn to love this person. That ain't the way it works. If you're working to love somebody, I guess I'm asking this with a question as well as with a statement. It's not something that you strive to start learning to love your girlfriend. It's not something that Jesus strived to start learning to love the people that are persecuting him. It's something that he was, and that's what Ray was saying. It's something that you are, you is. And how do you become that is without working on it? But working on it ain't going to do it.
Well, there's something wonderful about having parents when you're small that you can trust, that love you, just as a natural outflowing like of God's love, you know, to you, and that they love you no matter what you do, no matter what. And those things help you grow up understanding that kind of love. So people that don't grow up with that kind of love, I think it's harder for them to trust, to love, to, you know.
But maybe that's a gift rather than something you seek. I mean, you don't seek to love your girlfriend.
That's a good point, though, because, like, the little boy who was raised by wolves, how do you know that he's going to be a... How do you know that person is going to understand passion or love or any of the human understandings that we know? I mean, and there's a lot of people that fall into that category.
But you know, my dog was one of the most loving creatures or live things in my life. Those eyes that looked into mine, I mean, I read into them love.
He wasn't a wolf. He
wasn't a wolf, but I can imagine that a wolf or an animal could show you a lot of love. You know, they are caring and trusting. And
okay, maybe alligators.
Now I understand my wife.
Maybe alligators.
Sometimes about
they just, put the babies in their mouth and spit them out at the bottom of the creek. So maybe alligators. Or turtles, even. They even got it worse. Man, they got to crawl across the creek. They're like 2 inches long. And even, you know.
Oh, my goodness.
Oh, where are we at?
But what we're talking about is back to look, Jesus' love for mankind, which included everybody, and it was not something he strove to accomplish.
Right. He was love.
Yeah.
We can't. Should we strive to love everybody, or do we wait for it to happen? I have, as I grow older, I kind of have given up trying to force some subjects. I don't make it worse, but I don't force a subject that's not naturally there, because I've learned over the years that it really doesn't help the friendship.
Okay. Yes,
you can choose to act in love. And I don't want to say the emotion, because that's not where we're going with this. But yeah, you can choose to act out the verb that is love.
See, I think as humans, as humans, you know, are in our imperfect state. I think part of our education is that, you know, we have to choose to love. And by choosing to love when we don't feel like it, it becomes a part of us.
Okay, yeah. But there are people that actually I do respect, But every time I've tried to make a relationship, it backfired, and rather than force the issue, I just...
Does, in that situation, does love have to mean hang out with, talk to a lot, agree with, and all of that? Or does love in that situation mean show respect from a distance? Yeah.
Chapter 13, verses 1 through 3. If I speak in the tongues of men and of angels and have not love, I am a noisy gong or a clanging cymbal. And if I have prophetic powers and understand all mysteries and all knowledge, and if I have all faith so as to remove mountains but have not love, I am nothing. If I give away all I have and if I deliver up my body so that I may boast, but I have not love, I gain nothing. So, love and the spiritual gifts. No, it's not... Again, it's not spiritual gifts are inferior to love. It's not a devaluation of gifts. Paul assumes their value and their necessity. Okay? The spiritual gifts are necessary.
Which page? I think 4.
The list.
Number 4.
The list begins with tongues, which appears to be the most immediate concern of this essay, the exercise of tongues. Whether they are other languages, tongues of men, or of a celestial tongue, of angels. Paul is saying it's an exercise of tongues, manifestation of tongues is not a sign of spirituality. Corinth was noted for its brasswork. So in the marketplace, the banging and clanging of metal over which words could not be heard would have been a familiar image to the Corinthians.
Oh.
Next on the list is prophecy. And prophecy, this we're going to see, is what Paul considers a more useful gift compared to tongues. And that what he would like all to exercise. Both tongues and prophecy are what can be termed utterance gifts. Both involve speaking. Even though Paul considers prophecy a very valuable gift, he's saying by itself, it too is not a sign of spirituality. So, this is Bailey. No, this is not Bailey. This is understanding. Understand the Bible commentary has a sentence. Manifesting spiritual gifts, even the gift that Paul values, is useless without love. Then Paul goes on to mysteries and knowledge. And these were issues that Paul discussed earlier in this letter. Possessing knowledge and even being able to explain them are not signs of spirituality. And neither is faith. Faith has to remove mountains. So, we discussed at the very beginning of this whole series on 1 Corinthians that Corinth was located on an isthmus. There were two harbors, one on the east and one on the west. And there was a narrow path of about 3 to 5 miles, depending on which source you look at. And there was a mountain between the two. Well, not much of a mountain. It's a hill, 259 feet. But when you're talking about carrying a ship across, you know, with a maximum gradient of 6%, that's fairly steep. That's quite a bit of work.
Huge when you're carrying.
It's quite a bit of work. So, they made many efforts to try to dig a canal to remove the mountain to no effect until fairly recently in history.
I see. So, it's a very
ships and their cargo were carrying.
The Kizu Mountains was something that would be very valuable.
Yeah, it would have been literally very valuable if that mountain could have been removed, because many of the people who attended the Corinthian gathering assembly would probably have worked those roads.
Uh-huh. So when he says, I could say to this mountain, be moved, and it would... There's a literal mountain that they're thinking of.
And then Paul talks about giving of his body. And what he says is not even acts of self-giving or self-sacrifice is sufficient. Self-sacrifice is not love, although love is self-sacrificing.
Self-sacrifice,
and most translations at this point reads to be burned. Mm-hmm. If I give my body to be burned. Mm-hmm. But it's not found in the oldest manuscripts.
Well, self-sacrifice is an easy way to show love, then, if that's what they're saying, because like what all those things that he describes love as is all the things that you would have to relinquish from yourself in order to love that much. Like, you'd never even get mad when you were woke up five times in the night. You would never be hungry when you needed to feed somebody. And you know what I mean? All those things would be going on all the time, so that's way more sacrificial if you think about it than just being like, oh, well, I'm going to martyr myself pretty well. You know? Sounds like the easy way out, actually.
Kind of.
So when
living
Paul,
a daily sacrificial life. Yeah.
When Paul wrote this letter, martyrdom through burning was not known.
Oh, okay.
It's believed that later copyists changed boast, because boasting tends to carry a negative connotation, to burned, to match their own experience.
Oh, my.
Well, because
if I deliver up my body so that I might boast.
Yeah.
Well, see, that's what people do when they martyr themselves nowadays, is it to be forever remembered as somebody that loved you so much that they gave their lives to you. So it's a boast, big time.
In the Greek, the words boast and burned is identical except for one character.
So the word boast would look to someone who's thinking of martyrdom by burning, the word boast would look like. So it's a mistranslation.
Paul, as we have noticed, often sees boasting as a positive thing. Boasting about self-sacrifice, when done under the Spirit's guidance, is a beneficial thing.
Can be, I'm sure. He does it.
All
shameless self-promoters. Well, he is kind of...
He is very outspoken.
Yes. Passionately so. Huh.
It's about honor.
Huh.
Culture.
It's about God's honor.
What Paul is talking about in verse 3, if I give away all I have and I deliver up my body so that I may boast, but have not love, I gain nothing. Paul is talking, referring to the end of the age, when reward will be given, rewards will be handed out. Paul is saying, I can be self-sacrificing and I can boast about it all I want, but if it's not... But if there's no love involved in there, then there's no reward.
So you can't do it like a Jewish grandma who's always saying, I'm kidding,
I'm
kidding. Like they say in that Greek wedding movie, served up with a healthy helping of guilt. That's hard to say. All the love and affection.
Love and affection served with a healthy, keeping healthy.
Healthy helping.
A guilt.
A guilt.
So beautiful. You know, I read that somewhere this week that you don't need to have retribution feelings because God will do that in the end. Well, you know, God doesn't want to have retribution. That's not it.
No, but if you give her, but if you give the right to Him, then you can let Him be responsible for that.
I think what we need to be feeling is love for that person, not saying, well, God's going to get you in the end, you know. No, you should, God doesn't feel that way, and nor
neither should we. But sometimes when someone is just really, really angry at a situation and not able at that moment to say, no, I can love them instead. Sometimes they might be able to say, I can give God the right to the revenge.
Okay, I think that's really well revenge for people that are like dealing with each other on a daily basis, like politically or something like that, or they don't like the house color that their neighbor painted. That's all great and fine and dandy, but sadistic people that have done really bad things, or you know, situations where somebody's family member or child or, you know, close friend is hurt by somebody in a very bad way. Those are really hard people to care for. People that maliciously murder thousands of people for no reason.
Say, I can love them.
You know, but pray for them that their souls will eternally be saved is a very tough thing
Might someone be able to say, I can give God the right instead of claiming it myself?
You can, but I think you'd be taking a few years to get that one out.
Well, I'm not saying everybody in that situation is able to do that.
120 years to get those words out.
But there might be situations where someone can't love a person, but they might be able to say, I can give God the right to have revenge instead of keeping it myself. And some might not be able to go to either of those places and might still be loved of God.
The point is, you're not saying that you did or didn't go there.
Right.
God's not saving you because you do or not don't forgive somebody. What God is saying is, if you're not able to forgive, you're hurting your own body. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
So, my question is then, is this one of Paul's few times where he's actually speaking to individuals at this point? Because normally he's speaking to the body, to the church itself, to the actions of the church. But
well,
at this time it sounds like he's been talking.
It's both. Well, a community cannot exist without individuals.
Right.
Yeah.
So at this time, he is directly speaking to an individual's heart and what they
want. Well, yes and no.
Okay. See, that's where
it's
we have to question this guy, because usually I think, oh, this is my personal journey to God's light, and then it's like, no, this is the church. So I wonder.
Well, and I see a lot of things here that do seem to be talking to an individual. If I give my body be weird, and if I have this gift or that gift or that gift, that doesn't mean I have love. But I think, I suppose the group also needs to say, whatever good we are doing in the world, if we don't have love, then it doesn't matter.
Can you have love without community?
Can you have community without love?
Yeah.
Yeah.
Not a community.
Not a very, sometimes not a very nice community. Can you have community without love? Mm-hmm. Yes, but sometimes not a very nice community.
Right. Uh-huh. Community is not always nice.
Mm-hmm.
It's back to this cultural Western cowboy meme.
The Lone Ranger.
The Lone Ranger. We ain't the Lone Ranger.
The middle of this passage is love defined. So what is this love of which Paul speaks? Paul uses the word agape. Uh-huh. Greeks of Paul's day had two words, eros and philia, to describe love. Mm-hmm. Eros is the romantic love. Philia is the brotherly love. Mm-hmm. But for Paul, these were inadequate. The word agape appears in the Septuagint translation of the Song of Songs. Doesn't appear anywhere else in the Old Testament.
So does it not, is it a Greek word?
It is a Greek word. Its occurrence is rare in classical Greek.
Huh.
It was a seldom used word.
Huh. So they had two words that they generally use for love, but he's pulling in a rare word.
Paul selects this rarely used word to give it and fill it with new meaning. See, remember, Jesus spoke Aramaic. Uh-huh. He did not speak Greek. He did not use Greek.
He didn't use
the word. He did not use agape. Uh-huh. It was Christians who first used agape to refer to love, according to this.
What was it used for in the Old Greek?
Where's my reference here?
Well, you said you put a big definition on it.
It had, well, let's see if I can find it in Ken Bailey's book, 41:01. Probably not. May have known some words.
But this is a Greek community.
It means inclining toward something.
Huh. Okay.
That's what it meant in classical Greek.
And how do you know that?
So the way we understand, modern Christians typically, when they hear agape, you know, at least have an idea of what it means.
Yeah.
It was probably first used by Paul.
But to lean into someone would be closer to the well, I like them. I don't love them, but I like them.
And so in this middle section of chapter 13, Paul uses the word agape to define a new kind of love.
In other words, he defines it. He redefines the word in this chapter.
He redefines both the word agape as well as redefines what love means.
So when he says if you don't have love, you can be a sounding symbol of all this stuff. This is the agape message.
Yes.
Okay. So anywhere in this context we say love, we talk about agape, which is a word that he somewhat clarified.
Correct. Now, this section specifically refers to the Corinthian problems when Paul defines love negatively and what is missing from their community when he defines love positively. Love is personified. It becomes a person. So when he says love is, this love has become a person. It has become a character that walks onto this stage. To speak. I am. No, I, as love, am. Uh-huh. Or am not. And Bailey writes, Paul's ethical model is Jesus. So when we read love is, the first thing we should picture is Jesus speaking. The bookends of this middle section is love is patient and love endures all things. Both describe a kind of patience. Mm-hmm. Love is patient. The Greek word here is makrothymos, which means this is the patience of the powerful who have the clout to retaliate but choose to refrain. Love endures all things. Panta hypomene. If macrothymia is the patience of the powerful, hypomene is the patience of the weak who unflinchingly endure suffering.
Huh.
So the bookends are the strong and the weak. Both have to be patient. They have to be self-controlled in their different ways. One has power to retaliate, to force their desires, but refrains from doing so. The other has no power, but chooses to patiently endure.
I lost myself in the who's good, who's bad, what's going on here?
Verse 4, love is patient and kind. That is the powerful who chooses not to retaliate. And verse 7, love bears all things. That is the weak who chooses to patiently endure. He's describing two different expressions of love.
Maybe
both
endure with dignity.
Yeah.
You're able to eat poor, but kind of like the old days when people were poor and they were dignified with it. They scrimped and they saved and they kept their shoes or something, but they wouldn't let anybody help them.
Yeah.
Not out of pride, but just out of the fact that they can do it.
So the original words were, "Love is the patient of the powerful."
Yep, macro.
Love is the patient of the weak.
The word macrothymos includes the word thymos, which has to deal with the feelings of anger. The macrothymos is suppressing the expression of that anger.
Okay, say both those phrases in what you're thinking saying the interpretation of the words are.
Love is patient and kind. Love does not retaliate even when they have the power.
Yeah.
And in verse 7, love bears all things. Love, when love is weak, love chooses to endure patience.
So Jesus, as a divine being, in his time of passion, had the power to retaliate, but he chose not to. Jesus as a human being, as a man, was weak. He could do nothing but to suffer, to endure suffering.
Even in suffering, he did it with dignity.
It's an unflinching me. Endure suffering.
I'm trying to put a...
You don't complain.
Yeah.
You don't whine, you don't complain. You don't worry about the future. Yeah, it's not absolute power, but generally, you know, none of us are at the bottom of whatever hierarchy.
Yeah, we're not the bottom or top, but
there are more powerful people above us, there are weak, less powerful people under us. It's speaking to both sides.
And we are in different positions in different situations, too.
The squeaky wheel gets the grease. He's basically saying that he's refuting that privilege. But that's not right. Even if he's the bottom of the heap, you still have love that you can exhibit in your behavior.
The middle of this, the very middle now, goes into what love is not, the negatives. And this, these directly address how Corinthians were treating one another. First, envy. Love does not envy. They were envious of one another. In regards to different manifestations of spiritual gifts, certainly, but some claimed more knowledge or wisdom than the other. You know, some, at the very beginning, there were factions, there were divisions along the lines of who they followed. Apollos, Paul, Peter, Jesus. Love does not boast. This is the negative of, you know, boasting can be positive or negative. This is the negative kind of boasting. And boasting can be about one's own group. I'm better than, you know, we are better than you. Or it can be about flattering others to manipulate them. Mm-hmm. Love is not arrogant. Arrogance is about, I know better, I know more than you. No, I'm better than you. What it does is it stops listening to others. They no longer exist.
They don't matter.
Love is not rude. Or love is not without good order. And specifically, this may have been in regards to appearance. You know, in the early part of this essay, Paul discussed hair. You know, hair coverings, head coverings for women when they were prophesying and leading in worship.
And it was rude.
And it was rude. So it's about being concerned about how you present yourself to others. You know, think about what others will think when they see you or hear you. Love does not insist on its own way. This is the climax. This is the very center of the center. And Paul uses the word zete. And this may be a play on the word zelote, which is found at the beginning and end of this text that we're looking at. It has to do with kind of the zeal. Zealously guarding and insisting on my way, maybe, is what Paul is implying. The Corinthians were overly concerned about their individual spiritual status. Paul responds saying, Christian spirituality is about caring for the common good. It's not just about my rights, but it's about yours too. Love is not irritable. It's about self-control. It's about absorbing hostility. So when you experience hostility, you do not retaliate. You exercise self-control. In addition, it keeps no record of wrongs. This is an accounting metaphor. You don't keep a ledger to track wrongs to bring up later in order to exact revenge or to manipulate others by saying, look what you did to me. I deserve to treat you this way. Now, this doesn't mean forgetting what has happened. it doesn't mean that you should invite hostility.
Invite hostility back.
It's not about ignoring abuses.
It's not about being ignoring that.
Right. Sometimes this text overall has been used to say, your husband has abused you. Forgive him. Reconcile. That's not what it means. You cannot think of your abuser as a monster. But you do not have to have a relationship with that person. And no matter how evil a person is, they are still God's creation. Mm-hmm. What it means is don't allow the past to fester and to control your responses. But when you keep track of wrongs, often what happens is you dwell on that and that becomes a part of you. Mm-hmm. All your actions, even to people who have nothing to do with your past, become a victim of your past. It does not rejoice at injustice. And this injustice can be wrong actions of individuals, but it's far more than that. It's directed against all types of injustice and oppression. But particularly those that the world delights in, such as the excessive accumulation of wealth by abusing those who are weaker, or of violence. And perhaps most importantly and most difficult for people is it denounces delighting in the failures of others and gossiping about it. It rejoices when mercy and justice prevails, even with those whom we disagree. From verse 7, it's a four quick staccato phrases. Literally, it reads, all bears, all believes, all hopes, all endures. Bears can mean covers over. Can also mean doesn't leak. It can be used to describe a roof. What Ken Bailey suggests is it keeps all confidences. It's trustworthy. Love is trustworthy. Love bears and love endures is directed primarily towards other people.
So you're defining agape?
Yeah. Love believes and love hopes is directed primarily toward God. So love is trustworthy with one another. Love endures everything that happens in this human life. Love believes all that God has promised. Love hopes in the ultimate reward and the triumph of justice.
When did the term Christian come about?
Was in Antioch, in Acts.
And where's that relationship to Paul's?
Probably prior to Corinthians.
So you were trying to say that to be a Christian is basically trying to describe a person's characteristics rather than their affiliation. Mm-hmm. And Paul is trying to define, from what I'm seeing here, is a Christian has agape love is a Christian. He's basically defining what to be a Christian is.
Yeah. Originally, people who followed Jesus were called followers of the way. And it was in Antioch that they were first called Christians. Antioch of Syria versus Antioch of Pisidia.
Okay. So, it is defined in a kind of love. And in our shallow culture, this isn't the kind of love that everybody chuckles about. It's not February 14th, obviously.
No.
It is defined as a different kind of dignity, respect for others.
Hoping for their best. Mm-hmm.
Caring unconditional.
And you're saying, and I think a little bit of my reading, I'm finding out this. For us, we talk about, and it's all that plain and dandy, but in Greek and Roman, this wasn't the norm behavior between people. They didn't have a pagan life was different than we can envision.
In Greek and Roman life, household codes defined relationships. The father, the pater familia, was the head of the household. It was basically an autocrat. Now, he had Caesar above all, but Caesar, and then the father, then the wife, then the children, and the servants and slaves.
But Dolores was mentioning this last night, is we live in a culture that's kind of nice to each other, and when she goes to the grocery store and she bumps into someone, she says, oh, excuse me, I'm sorry. Or we're polite, we're giving, and there's a flow of nicety. And some communities, some cities have it, some cities, communities don't quite have it.
You know, or this road rage or something.
Yeah.
You're like,
get out. Yeah, I've noticed down south on the freeway, the courtesies of life have changed somewhat in driving patterns in some places, some cities.
Yeah.
What I'm finding out is the courtesies of life, I don't think existed in some cultures the way we expect, we observe them now.
Well, everything was about honor and shame. You know, all actions were interpreted as either gaining honor or losing honor. So if you didn't respond and react and retaliate in some way, you lost honor if you were wrong in some way.
So that's kind of like the British and tipping your hat to people. A British lord walking down a grocery aisle isn't going to say, oh, excuse me, I'm sorry for bumping you. A British lord is going to get out of my way.
He wouldn't have even been in the country.
But that's basically the culture that you're thinking of, is that it went all the way until, you know, 400 years before the United States, basically. And that's the culture that existed all the way up until then, is that you had the households and then the people below them. So your honor was left to where your place in society was. So if you were in the shops or down in the market and the king and his family passed, you had to tip your hat to every person in his household down to his servant because they were higher than you and what you were part of, the household of his brother. And then you tipped your hat all the way down to the lords in his household and then raised your head when the servants passed by. So on and so forth, all the way down to
everyone had a specific place in society, and you had to observe it correctly.
Birthright, things like that. There was no such thing as somebody being, and even if you were born in poverty and you somehow made it through and developed a business of your own and were successful, you were still limited in society by your birthright, the fact that you didn't come from the house. The only way to increase your birthright was to have a child and be married to somebody as of a higher rank than your household.
Maybe that's hard.
Well, remember, this essay, this entire essay is dealing with social order and worship.
Right, but what you're saying is that it was the mom that they're supposed to be tribute. And what I'm discovering is, to us, that model is kind of like, yeah, be nice. But to them, it was novel. It was something foreign. It was not something that they were familiar with.
Yeah.
When Paul uses the pattern of household codes in his letters, like Ephesians.
Uh-huh.
You know, he follows it, but what he introduces is that those above must also respect those below.
Uh-huh. You know, and that was a new thing.
That was a radically new idea. Right, so within the framework of social structure, Paul is trying to break it down. No, he can't break it down completely. But he's going to introduce theological concepts that will eventually lead to breaking down.
And society is still hung up on a king. And a benevolent king has almost never been in service in history. I mean, it's kind of been touched on, but there's never been a ruler that actually expressed these forms of love in history as we know
toward
it.
His people.
And we've tried with a president saying, oh, well, they can come from anywhere. But we've never elected a president that didn't go to an Ivy League school. So we still have some essence of reasoning that our leaders and the people above us need to be above us. Still got a long way to go.
The last paragraph of chapter 13 reads, love never falls. As for prophecies, they will pass away. As for tongues, they will cease. As for knowledge, it will pass away. For we know in part, we will prophesy in part, but when the perfect comes, the partial will pass away. When I was a child, I spoke like a child, I thought like a child, I reasoned like a child. When I became a man, I gave up childish ways. For now we see in a mirror dimly, but then face to face. For I know in part, then I shall know fully, even as I have been fully known. So now faith, hope, and love abide these three, but the greatest of these is love. The main thing to note about this last section is that Paul divides things into two categories, those things that are permanent and those things that are temporary. And the temporary will no longer be necessary when the eschaton arrives in its fullness. Well, the fullness of the kingdom comes.
I guess I don't quite understand that one.
Love is the most permanent of the things discussed. It never falls. This is the imagery of a mountain pass and a drop off on the other side.
I don't understand the gifts.
Prophecy, tongues, and knowledge are examples of temporary gifts. You know, prophecy is knowledge, proclamations that are given through the Spirit in order to build up the church. Tongues, we will see later on as we go through chapter 14, are gifts that edify one's own personal worship. You know, as a means of drawing close to God. But when God is there in person, there's no need for tongues. Knowledge, too, is a temporary gift because it's one thing, there is no humans do not possess complete knowledge. And any knowledge that we have is a gift. This is knowledge. No, this is not talking about facts, but it's talking about that relational knowledge. Once again, when God is there in person, well, there's no need for
the rituals. And, you know,
so no one can stand up and explain what God is, because God is standing right there or living with you. So the example will be there.
All of the gifts are given to as partial revelations of God in order to build up the church.
So when God is there, He will tell us the perfect truth, and we don't have to hash it out anymore because He is it.
Again, that's our culture. He doesn't tell us, He lives it.
So one of the things that Paul writes is that which is incomplete versus complete, partial versus fully. And so we must be ever aware of the partialness or the incompleteness of our knowledge and proclamations, including this one, what we're doing here.
Like, we have to describe to Lorene everything we could so that she could move around safely and experience something around her. But what if she could see, none of our explanations would be necessary.
Paul goes on to explain and expound using two parables. The first one is the parable of child and man. Now, this is not Paul saying he has reached spiritual maturity. What he is saying, just as when I became a man, I gave up childish ways in real life. When Christ returns in the future to usher in the full eschaton, the temporal gifts will also go away. Just as I gave up childish ways in my literal life. So don't think of the spiritual gift as permanent possessions. And then the parable of the mirror. Mirrors were made from brass. Again, another Corinthian product. The analogy of this parable isn't quite perfect, because when you look in the mirror, you see yourself. But the parable reads that when the mirror disappears, we will see face to face. So it's one of those things where you don't take the parable too literally.
Yeah.
Which is why such, like the King James says, through a dark glass darkly, because it actually does make a little more sense. The parable is more consistent, but it's not accurate to the language. Yeah, and what happens to brass is that it tarnishes.
So
in other words, if we think of the parable as through a clouded glass, seeing Christ through a clouded glass, it makes more sense. But if what he was actually talking about in their culture was a brass mirror.
Yeah.
But did they have glass? They probably didn't have glass.
No. Probably not.
Well.
So the point here again is it's about our incomplete view about God during this time of existence. And this no, again, it's not about factual propositional knowledge. It's about relational knowledge. What's that? Where Paul writes, as I am fully known.
That's where our culture, we don't understand that whole concept of
or like Gavin knows. but you said that wasn't going to be in this chapter.
Well, it's about intimacy. To be fully known is to have to get rid of all those barriers.
The barriers are removed.
So there is nothing separating my knowing your knowing. I let down my guard.
open arms get to.
Or there's nothing separating my or me from God.
Paul is such a smart man on interpersonal relations, etc., 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 etc. Where was his family?
He's just an expert at it, so he must not have one.
The church was his family.
Faith, hope, and love abide, and the greatest of these is love. Now, the problem in interpretation of this is, you know, we can see how love is permanent, but what about faith and hope? And there's really no consensus. Scholars have different opinions. Some think they're all permanent and have explanations as to how they are. Some think, you know, faith and hope are permanent in that, or they abide in that they will go on to the very end of, you know, until the fullness arrives. But love is the one that is permanent, that will go on to eternity. That's why it's the greatest.
So faith and hope both concern the future, as it concern our thoughts about the future, or are they not limited to what we feel about the future?
I think faith and hope are a foundation of security that allows you to love.
Yeah.
Because, you know, your hope is founded in God, your trust is founded in God, and that security allows you to launch off in a life of love because you have a foundation of love and faith, hope, trust, whatever, you know. So it's kind of like building your foundation in something secure.
You have to have something that you trust in order to really love. Yeah.
If you're not secure, it's harder
then you
to
can't
open up to
have
people.
A functional relationship. You can't love properly. Yeah. So in that sense, faith and hope could also represent the security that you continue to have, even when everything is fulfilled. Still, that trust remains.
A couple paragraphs as we end here. From the New International Commentary, Gordon Fee writes, "One must not mistake this emphasis with a devaluation of the gifts themselves. The fact is that we are still in the present, and therefore in chapter 14, Paul will go on not only to correct an imbalance with regard to the gifts, but to argue, to urge their proper use. Pursue love, he says, because that alone is forever, but that also means that in the present you should eagerly desire manifestations of the Spirit that build up the community." It is not difficult to bring the final verse of this paragraph into the contemporary church. These are still the three imperishables for those who would live a truly Christian life in the present age. What is more difficult is the way the emphasis on the present only aspect of the gift has been treated. Most have simply yielded to the historical reality and have tried to make a virtue out of that reality, that for the most part, these extraordinary gifts have already ceased for so many. The irony, of course, is that our present view is almost the precise opposite of that of the Corinthians, who thought of these things as eternal and therefore needed to have that view corrected. One wonders how Paul would have responded to present-day cerebral Christianity, which has generally implied that we can get along quite well without the Spirit in the present age, now that the church has achieved its maturity in orthodoxy. It seems likely that he would not be pleased to see this text used to support such a view of things.